The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
Welcome to the future you. Frank Lloyd Wright once said, "Study nature, love nature, stay close to nature, and it will never fail you." At Zija, we love nature. We study nature. In India, we discovered Moringa and created Moringa Supermix, a revolutionary new combination of organic ingredients, including natural vitamins, minerals, proteins, antioxidants, and omega oils. Zija's new Moringa Supermix will help you make a change for the better. Simply click on the Zija banner on the UKHealthRadio.com homepage. Power people need power vitality.
Hello and welcome to this week's Yes to Life show. I'm Robin Daly, your host for the show, and each week I speak to people involved in the development of integrative medicine for cancer, both people on the receiving end and those pushing the frontiers of treatment in the clinic or in the lab. This week, I'm honoured to be talking to a giant in the field of research and cancer theory, Professor Thomas Seyfried. Professor Seyfried can justifiably be credited with single-handedly putting metabolic theory back on the agenda after decades of being sidelined by genetic theory, the currently accepted foundation of the cancer process. He's a passionate advocate for change, and at times this interview can get quite technical. But what he's saying is so important, I urge you to hang in there with him to the end to allow the enormity of what he's saying to sink in. The professor's come to the UK to speak at a London conference and very kindly agreed to step out for long enough to speak to us on the Yes to Life show. Professor Seyfried, thanks so much for taking time out of what I bet is a really hectic schedule here in the UK to speak to us on the Yes to Life show.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Robin.
So, Professor Paul Davies, in his NCI role as Principal Investigator in the Centre for Convergence of Physical Science and Cancer Biology, he came to the conclusion that the whole effort of cancer research is charging down the wrong path. So I'd like to know what you think about his conclusion.
Paul Davies.
Yeah, Paul Davies.
Sure, I know him well.
Yeah, good.
He's of the Beyond Center in Arizona.
Yeah.
Right?
That's the man.
And I've had a lot of talks with Paul.
All right.
He knows, he was asked by the NCI to come in and try to resolve or help better understand what the nature of cancer was.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul was able to look at all perspectives. And you'd say, why would you take someone who studied life on different planets or something like this to help the National Cancer Institute figure where they're going? So, and Paul, of course, was glad to help out. If he didn't know much about cancer, he told me, because I really was kind of stunned that they would ask me, you know. Right. So that just tells you how desperate the National Cancer Institute is to ask somebody that studies interplanetary life to help understand. But Paul was able to bring it back to more primitive kinds of metabolic problems that cancers have. And I think he has this atavistic theory of the origin of the disease, which is, you know, in line with what we think as well. The tumor cells are simply reverting back to an ancient primitive pathways of metabolism. And that's what's driving their proliferative growth.
Hmm.
You know, we've defined and outlined that very, very clearly in our work. And that's predominantly what the cancer cells are doing. So, you know, you can deny that. If you look at the data, it's very hard to deny. You have to be almost brain damaged not to be able to understand the evidence.
Right,
of this.
Yeah.
So then if you can't understand the evidence, then it must be some other reason why. It can't
sure.
be because you can't comprehend or understand the data. You would ignore it because there are other interests that may be involved, and therefore you have to link yourself to the conventional view, despite evidence that the conventional view is fundamentally misguided.
Mm. So you're with Professor Davies anyway?
I'm not with him, but I've gone to meetings with him.
Right.
And I've listened to what he has to say. He works with a few people that, you know, have this idea. But, you know, our idea on the origin of cancer is strongly linked to the biochemical evidence of decades worth of research. So we link everything to testable hypotheses that can fully evaluate whether or not cancer is a mitochondrial disease or whether it's a genetic disease. And when you do all those kinds of experiments, the answer is that it's a mitochondrial metabolic disease and not a genetic disease. So when you look at the data from the experiments that were done to test the hypothesis. So once you make the decision that this is, or come to the realization, not make a decision, but come to a realization, then you say, most of what we're doing in the cancer field has little relevance to the problem of people suffering from the disease. So do we want to continue to fund massive research programs that have little relevance to the cancer patient, or do we want to step back and go in a different direction? And unfortunately, the populace, whatever country that happens to be in, whether it's UK, America, Japan, Germany, are mostly left out of the discussion. It's a discussion among professional scientists. Right? So the poor guy on the street is just dragged around for whatever the so-called group thinks. And they assume that the guys that are directing their management of their disease know what they're doing. And if they knew what I knew, they would be appalled. Because they're not being treated with therapies that are based on the fundamental origin of the disease. So there's the rub. And consequently, in the United States, we have over 1,600 people a day dying from cancer. The incidences are increasing, the deaths are increasing worldwide. In China, it's over 8,100 people a day are dying from cancer in China. So, and this is all because of a fundamental misunderstanding. And if people were to understand that cancer is a mitochondrial metabolic disease, the treatments and solutions become so much more clear, less toxic, and less expensive. So why are we not going that direction?
Well,
because the population doesn't know about it.
Right. Okay. Well, we are pushing for the population to know about this kind of thing. Hence, you're on the Yes to Life show. So, yeah, people have referred to you as the grandfather of modern metabolic research in cancer. And metabolic theory itself is the best part of a century old at this point. But it's long failed to raise any interest, let alone as a research capital, until the arrival of your book.
Yeah. Well, what I had done is I had investigated the results that we were getting in our preclinical studies and looking at previous case report studies in humans and asking what's going on. We were seeing fundamental changes in tumor growth in a variety of different ways. And we all linked it back to what Otto Warburg had said. Otto Warburg knew precisely what caused cancer. It was a insufficiency of respiration. Problem with Otto Warburg is that he didn't have all of the parts of the puzzle. There were so many people who said that Warburg was wrong because so many cancer cells consume oxygen and therefore they have normal respiration. And the fundamental issue of Warburg was that all cancer cells have defective respiration. And they did a lot of that study in cells growing in culture. And cells growing in culture do in fact take up oxygen, but they continue to ferment. And they said the cancer cell chooses to ferment even though it has normal respiration. Well, this makes no sense. This is a teleological argument, a creationism, right?
Yeah.
Designed with a purpose. Yet the field ran off onto this absurdity. And Warburg was pretty much thrown under the bus, but it was not only for that, for the failure to see all of these things, but also because the hysteria over the discovery of DNA in 1953 as the genetic material. Earlier than that, but you know, Watson and Crick's work led to a hysterical migration of all kinds of scientists into the molecular DNA biology, and the cancer field went headlong into this as well. And then they discovered that, or they made the claim that all this metabolic stuff was ultimately the result of gene defects.
Right.
Okay. So, but you know, the problem is,
effect.
Yeah. Well, the gene defects were driving the abnormal metabolism, and that's what persists today, because God forbid people come to realize that Otto Warburg was correct. And I did my book trying to find every argument against Warburg's theory and show the flaws in all of the arguments against Warburg's theory. And not only that, we also found that they ferment amino acids, which is the missing link in Warburg's theory. So clearly Warburg was right. He just didn't have all of the pieces of the puzzle. Once you understand that, then you say Warburg's theory was correct. We know how to manage cancer. We know what causes cancer. And now we can develop effective, non-toxic, cost-effective therapies to manage the disease. And we can do that. And our Press Pulse paper, the design of what we proposed, we published a paper showing how precisely to degrade tumors gradually and slowly without harming the rest of the body using metabolic therapy.
Hmm. That's very important. Okay, I'd like to come back to that if I can. So it was literally the results that you were bumping into that were leading you to focus your attention in this, what was really essentially an unfashionable backwater of research. Metabolic theory, nobody was looking at it very much.
Well, there were a few guys. Pete Peterson at Johns Hopkins was considered the guy who kept the ember burning.
Right.
You know, he wrote the foreword to my book. He was doggedly pursuing the metabolic problem, and people gave him money only because he was like the only guy doing this, so it really wasn't disturbing anything. Until he found a chemical, 3-bromopyruvate, which seemed to have a lot of effect on killing cancer cells by targeting energy metabolism. And he has the book, in Tripping Over the Truth, Travis Christofferson's book.
Yes.
He went through the discussion of this discovery. But then he was Pete was unable to get any more grant. Once you find something that it might actually work, you don't get funding anymore.
Right.
So you get a lot of funding for studying cancer.
Hmm.
You get very little funding to try to resolve it. Because most people think cancer cannot be resolved effectively. Therefore, we study the same things, mTOR pathways, you know, AKT signaling, HIF-1 alpha, over and over and over, thousands and thousands of papers showing the same thing, just done in a little bit different way.
Hmm.
But the industries are happy about that because they keep a lot of very smart people doing silly things.
Right.
And therefore, nothing gets back out into the clinic. So everybody thinks that, we're doing all this cancer research. And it's the same stuff done over and over again.
Mm.
And nothing is linked back to the clinic unless it involves some extremely expensive immunotherapy or some nonsense like this that's based on the gene theory. And you're not going to have any major impact by using immunotherapies. They make it like they're hyping it all up and they make it.
I know. Well,
it's based
on
the gene theory. It's based on the gene theory. So if the gene theory has been effectively undermined, as we've done, then this makes no sense to do this.
Hmm.
And this is what everybody thinks is going to be the new solution. How many times have we heard this over the decades?
Too many.
Too many. All because it's linked to a misunderstanding of what the fundamental disease. Once you come to the realization, cancer becomes a very manageable disease.
Hmm.
And you can manage it without toxicity. And people say, you can't. Listen, it can happen. We have seen it preclinically in a few case report studies. We're seeing it. We need to work it out. It's not completely resolved. It's not completely worked out in all areas. But we have a light at the end of the tunnel that's guiding us to a therapeutic approach that's going to be very successful.
Mm-hmm.
If people just get out of the way.
Right. Yeah, there are people in the way for sure.
Oh, big
time, yes. Okay, so look, some of our listeners won't be so good on their cancer theory. So can we just sort of go back to basics and just talk in simplest terms, I know this is a big ask, but the simplest terms, the difference between the orthodox view of cancer, what it is, how it works, and why their treatments are as they are, and that, now the metabolic view, how that works, and what the treatments might look like in that case.
Okay, so if we go by the gene theory, which is what most people who do cancer research and which most clinicians and scientists think, they all talk about gene mutations in cancer. And in fact, many cancers do have a lot of gene mutations. The dogmatic view is that you have this one mutation and then you get a sequential series of mutations that eventually disturb the growth pattern, the growth regulation of the cell, and then the cell becomes dysregulated in growth, okay? And this has been what they call the somatic mutation theory of cancer, which is the foundation for the gene theory that cancer is a genetic disease. And right now, it's not clear how many mutations it would take to cause any cell to be a tumor. But you have to go back to Bovary's work in the early 1900s, Theodore Bovary, where he said that development of sea urchins became abnormal when their chromosomes became abnormal. So he then worked with a German pathologist who looked at cancer cells and looked at the chromosomes in these cancer cells and also found the chromosomes in the cancer cells to be abnormal. So Bovary concluded that maybe this dysregulated growth that you see in tumors has something to do with the chromosomal abnormalities. However, the German pathologist felt that this chromosomal abnormalities were a secondary. He didn't agree with Bovary. The actual guy who was looking at the chromosomes didn't agree with him. He said, no, let's do something else. It kind of festered around for decades. Warburg was doing his beautiful metabolic work, and a lot of people were linked to the fact that cancer was, in fact, a metabolic disease based on Otto Warburg, because he was a giant in the field. He was considered one of the most dominant biochemists of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. So he had amassed massive evidence that cancer cells are fermenting, all right? And he considered the chromosomal abnormalities and gene mutations and all that other stuff as downstream epiphenomena. And he said, basically, cancer is a disease of energy metabolism, and that if old ancient fermentation procedure takes over from normal respiration, and therefore the cancer loses its growth control because it begins to ferment. So that was the, and he said if we can, his view was we can manage cancer if we can keep respiratory enzymes healthy. And he tried to manage cancer by using various supplements and add-ons. He felt that we could stop cancer if we could keep respiratory enzymes in a good state. And we know now that that's not possible. But he knew the origin of the disease, the strategy that he had to try to manage it was not going to work. But anyway, the gene theory continued on. And then to test the gene theory, they took various viruses, and they would engineer the virus to have a mutation. And then they would treat proliferating cells that were not neoplastic or tumorigenic. And then they would treat these cells with the virus, and then they would find the cells would become transformed and form cancer. So this was considered more of a direct evidence that cancer is a genetic disease, because if I introduce a viral particle with a mutation, it would take normally proliferative cells and then make them carcinogenic in the way, or neoplastic, where you take the cells and put them in the back of a mouse or something and you get a tumor. Right. Tumorigenic.
Right.
All right. Rather than, but the cells were already one step, the cells that they treated with the virus were already one step on the proliferative pathway. They were normal NIH3T3 cells that were already proliferating. So they were highly proliferative, but they weren't forming tumors. You put the virus in there with a gene mutation, and then you get the tumor. Therefore, direct evidence that genes cause cancer, right? Mm. However, that same virus also damaged the respiration, and nobody ever looked at that. And Warburg was saying it was always the respiratory problem. So basically what I did is I went out and I took all these studies where they had done nuclear transfer. They took the nucleus out of a tumor cell and they put the nucleus into a normal cell. Now the nucleus is supposed to contain the genes that drive the disease because it's an oncogene tumor suppressor gene phenomenon. But when you take the nucleus with all the gene mutations and put it into a new cytoplasm, you no longer get dysregulated cell growth. Hmm. So this, and I showed over and over again all these experiments. And I analyzed the results on two fundamental concepts, the mitochondrial metabolic theory of Warburg and the gene theory, as in the current dogma. And in every case, almost every case, you could clearly see how the cytoplasm and the mitochondria were dictating the abnormal behavior of the tumor cells. It wasn't the nucleus. Because you could take a normal nucleus and put it into the cytoplasm of a tumor cell, and you would get cancer from the cytoplasm. And even though the nucleus was supposed to be normal and didn't have any tumor suppressed, didn't have any mutations, the cells went on to become tumorigenic. Whereas the opposite study showed that you could take a nucleus of a tumor cell and put it into a normal cytoplasm and you control the growth. So the British geneticist C.D. Darlington, years ago, he was a leader in genetics from UK, looked, and he was brought in as almost like Paul Davies.
Right.
He was brought in as an outside observer. And he looked at the data from chromosomal abnormalities. He said, this is clearly a cytoplasmic phenomenon. It's not a nuclear phenomenon. But he was thrown, he was discarded because he didn't go along with the crowd.
He didn't have the right answer.
Yeah, he didn't have the right answer. Mm. So the field just continued to morph. So more and more experiments were showing more and more genetic mutations in cancer and all this kind of stuff. But they never addressed those tumors that have no mutations, which we know of. There are cancer cells that have no mutations.
Right?
They've looked for the most powerful sequence. They can't find any mutations.
Oh, I didn't know that.
All right.
Okay,
so, and then there's also a whole bunch of normal cells in our bodies and the skin and different organs that have oncogene mutations, and they have no cancer. Driver genes, mutations in driver genes present in normal growing cells, cells that are not neoplastic. How do you explain that? Right. And then you have cancer cells that have no mutations. So this completely undermines. And then when you do the nuclear transfer experiments, it's the nail in the coffin.
Right.
The people just simply cannot accept those findings. Okay? So consequently, we're stuck in this vortex of absurdity,
right,
which leading us down a path of continual suffering and death as the result of trying to target mutations, precision medicine, you know, personalized medicine, targeting genes, you know, trying to make immunotherapies to attack tumor cells that have various mutations that are irrelevant to the nature of the disease. All the tumor cells are fermenting. If you remove the fermentable fuels, they die. And people say, too simple, can't happen. Well, I've showed the data. It happens. It's very easy.
Right. Yeah, so, I wanted to talk to you about those experiments because it's like, they're monumental, aren't they? These ones where they actually took the healthy nucleus and put it into a cancer cytoplasm and it becomes a cancer cell.
And vice versa.
Yeah. That's the really exciting one, is that you take a cancer nucleus and put it into the healthy cytoplasm and it all behaves itself.
Yes, so, and the mutations are still there. You can still see the mutations there. It's epigenetic. It's epigenetic. What do you mean it's epigenetic? What is epigenetics? Well, it's when the cytoplasm. Then they give you this cock and bull story about what epigenetics is, right? Epigenetics is an extremely complicated phenomenon. But in fact, it is an epigenetic phenomenon because it's controlled by it's an extra nuclear epigenetic phenomenon.
Yes.
It's the mitochondria that dictates the differentiated state of the cell. So it's an extra nuclear epigenetic system. People all think epigenetics takes place methylation, phosphorylation, acetylation. That's all intranuclear epigenetics. But there's an extra cytoplasmic epigenetic system called the mitochondria. And it's the most powerful regulator of epigenetics in the cell. And people still ignore it.
Mm. So those experiments are telling us very big things about cancer, aren't they? That's the first thing, as you pointed out. They lay the blame squarely in the environment that the nucleus is in.
Yeah,
and they also show that this is something we can influence. That we have the power to change this, with things that are actually everyday factors. It turns out, with what you call lifestyle medicine, it comes in the door at this point, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, I think lifestyle medicine, I think, is really good to prevent cancer. Like I said in my book on chapter 19, I believe, to prevent cancer, you have to keep your mitochondria healthy. And that's a lifestyle issue.
Right.
So you engage in risky lifestyle behaviors, you risk damaging the mitochondria in a population of your cells in some organ that could put you at risk for the development of a neoplastic behavior, neoplasia or cancer.
Mm.
Okay, those are preventative and they're lifestyle issues. Once you have the disease and it begins to spread through the body, right? A lifestyle change will be partially therapeutic, but it's not likely to resolve your cancer.
Agreed.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you need to have both the lifestyle change and you need certain drugs and procedures that work together with that to now restore the normalcy of your organ and to selectively and slowly kill off the tumor cells. They will die. They will die and they will not be able to recover. If you do it the right way, it's a staged process. We call it press pulse, and we adapted that from the field of paleobiology.
Okay.
So that's a strategy where we put pressure on one fuel, glucose, which we can, easy, and then we target the glutamine, the other fuel. There's only two fuels that drive the beast, glucose and glutamine. Glucose is very easy to target because our bodies don't need glucose. Okay, glucose, we have ketone bodies that will replace glucose as a natural fuel. We don't have as easy task to manage glutamine. You need drugs to do that. So it's a combination of pressing glucose down and elevating and sequentially pulsing to target the glutamine issue. So once we are able to do that, we can slowly degrade and not the cancer. And not only that, we improve all of the physiological parameters. If you have type 2 diabetes, that's also managed. It's unbelievable. If you have cardiovascular disease, that can improve significantly. So the same process to eliminate the cancer in your body is also recovering other malady, because many of these people who have cancer are suffering from all kinds of systemic inflammation.
Right.
They have all kinds of other issues.
Right.
They're metabolically a mess. But when you get rid of the cancer, you're also getting rid of their other problems. So they emerge from the therapy healthier than when they started. No hair loss, no vomiting, no nausea. Maybe a little bit at the beginning, only because of the dramatic change in diet. And that can cause some people to get a little queasy. But once you do it gradually, it usually, the problem we have right now is compliance. how you can keep people compliant with the metabolic therapy. And that's why the Press Pulse strategy is designed to complete the process within a 6 or 8 month period. So long-term compliance, rigid compliance, becomes unnecessary. So that's our strategy. We don't want people to be, oh, for the rest of my life, I can never have a chip,
right,
or a crisp, or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
You know, we don't want to convey that kind of a discomfort. We want to be able to take care of this cancer problem in a reasonable period of time, just like standards of care, but without toxicity, based on the fundamental knowledge of what the disease actually is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's totally different than what exists today.
Yes, and this ability to deal with more than one chronic problem at once does again point towards the same root.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely true. Like, we know that systemic inflammation can put people at risk for cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Incidence of cancer is higher in people with type 2 diabetes than in people who don't have type 2 diabetes, right? So what does type 2 diabetes do? It creates systemic inflammation, and you can see that by measuring C-reactive protein.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens in some people is that you get a population of cells that become destabilized metabolically as the result of the inflammation, and they go on the path to become a neoplasia. In the breast, if you have an occluded milk duct, you create a chronic hypoxic situation that then damages the respiration, leading to the formation of a tumor in those cells of that organ. And you can have the same thing in the colon, the bladder, all cancers are essentially the same. And this is another problem with the field. They all think their own cancer is totally different from everybody else's cancer, right? Brain cancer is different from colon cancer. No, it's all the same. When you look at what the cells are doing, they're all fermenting. And this is what we have seen over and over and over again. All the cancer cells use glucose and glutamine to survive. That's a clue. They're screaming. Mm. Look at my weakness. I just need these two fuels. If you take these fuels away from me, I will die, whether I'm a colon cancer, bladder cancer, brain cancer, or whatever. But we don't do that. We surgically mutilate these poor people, creating a wound. Then we bring them into high-dose radiation, creating a massive amount of necrosis in the environment. And then we
More
use toxic poisons. I mean, how are you going to... Sure, and then we have survivors. And these poor people come out of this they're beat up by the treatments. And now they become a candidate for cancer survivor medicine.
Right.
A new branch of medicine.
That's a whole new branch.
This is absurd.
Yeah.
You know, now they have digestive problems, they have depression, they have cardiovascular disease, hormonal imbalances, they have all kinds of stuff they never had but for the fact they survived toxic poisons and radiation. So the question we have to ask ourselves, why were you poisoned and irradiated in the first place? Well, I had to stop the proliferating tumor cells. The chemicals are going to stop the proliferation by binding to the DNA and causing them, and then the radiation is going to cause a tremendous amount of oxidative stress, and it's going to cause the tumor cells to blow up, and they're sort of stop dividing. If you take away glucose and glutamine, they'll die. They're going to die anyway. You don't have to harm the rest of the body. Well, that can't be that simple. That's because you haven't read the literature, nor do you know the biology of the problem. So what are you supposed to say? You know, and a lot of guys just turn and walk away because they don't want to hear what I have to say. They don't want to look at the data to make sure that what I'm saying is right, because God forbid they're going to have to do something different in their practices.
Well, quite. Yes, the consequences for individual doctors are enormous, of course.
Yeah,
they wouldn't know what to do with a piece of information.
Well, you know, I think the physicians are good-meaning people. I think they really are interested in, majority of them are interested in the health and welfare. They wouldn't go into the profession in the first place, I think, if they weren't. It's just they were never trained to know what I just said. They were never exposed to the information. So it's not their fault. It's the fault of the system. The system thinks cancer is a genetic disease. Why are we going to waste time telling our young physicians, medics and things, that, you know, you should really understand how to use food as medicine, and you need to know how to use specific non-toxic drugs with that specific food to kill the tumor cells? They're going to say, well, this is nonsense. Well, they don't read the literature. And if they do read the literature, they think that the mutations are driving the metabolism rather than the reverse.
Mm-hmm.
So you see there's a lot of twists and turns in this whole argument.
There definitely are. Well, look, your book has made a difference in as much as it's almost respectable to be talking metabolic theory in public these days, in a way that it certainly wasn't a few years back. It was risible as a subject a few years back. So that's a major achievement. My sense is that it's gone a lot further in the States than here. You may think things are bad over there, but I think they're a lot worse here.
Yeah.
We're still up against the major cancer charities here will have their top 10 myths, and you know, the idea that there's any connection between glucose and cancer is just like, this is just one of the biggest myths ever, you know, over here. And they're still putting out this kind of propaganda, essentially, yeah. as you say, it's nothing to do with science.
Well, you know, here's the problem with the cancer charities and things. We have the same problem in the States. They have it everywhere. It's not just UK. It's, listen, they're all meeting. They have all these people at brain cancer, breast cancer, whatever it is. They have a big, you know, Susan Coleman breast cancer research. Right. So, and they also lock on to these so-called myths. But when you look at on their scientific advisory board? All people have to do is look up the members of the scientific advisory board and then look at what they publish in the scientific literature, mm-hmm. and invariably it's cancer is a genetic disease. It's going to chase down some mutation. What kind of a response, and the good-meaning layperson who a loved one has perished or suffered from the cancer, they want to take their money and they want to set up a special foundation to give meaning to the life of their lost loved one. Basically, as they set this up, and who do they contact? Their scientific advisory board members, and they feel that these people are distinguished enough to give them the right information. Wrong.
Big mistake.
So, big mistake.
Yeah.
And therefore, you continue to perpetuate the myth is that that the current standards of care are failing our patient population. The current standards of care are based on cancer as a genetic disease, which has now been undermined very, very sufficiently. So when you realize that the very understanding of the nature of the disease is flawed, what do you think is going to happen to cancer deaths and incidence of these cancers? It's going to go up. People are going to continue to die in mass from a failed understanding or acceptance of what the nature of the disease is. Mm-hmm. So we're going to have this continual problem until the people themselves hear about this, and they demand, because they are ultimately the consumer.
Right.
Okay, if they say to their physician, I don't want radiation and chemo, I want metabolic therapy. And they'd be dismissed. Well, I'm not going to see you. And then he'll do that to one after, and all of a sudden the guy has nobody to talk. He's all, where's all his people going? Well, they're going over to the guy who's going to treat him as a metabolic problem rather than as a genetic problem. Mm. So they're going to have to come on board at some time. Otherwise, they're going to have nobody to practice medicine on.
Yeah, well, I think you're right. The public is the only hope, really, for change.
I think the public has to become more engaged. And I think their dismissal of let me go to the top medical oncology, and they're good people there. They'll help. I'm going to the best. Are you kidding me? You're going to the best. Why? You shouldn't have to have any nausea, vomiting, or discomfort. Why your hair falls out if you go to the best? I mean, what are they doing that you would treat somebody and their hair falls out? You know, why would this person be so sick near death? These are the best people, and they're making you that sick. They're clueless as to the biology. You go into any oncology clinic, and you ask them, "Do you know who Otto Warburg was and what he actually said and did?" No, I didn't know. Most of them don't know. Never heard. How can you be treated for a disease when the very origin of the disease is not understood by the people treating you? Mm-hmm. What do you think the outcome is going to be? You're going to either die from your cancer, or you're going to be so damaged from the treatment you're going to wish you died, or you're going to be suffering for the rest of your life with all kinds of maladies as the result of being treated mistreated. So it's an unbelievable situation, and it's happening everywhere. Not the UK, in the United States as well, believe me. And in China, the same thing. In India, the same thing. In Germany, the same thing. So you know where it's going to? I tell you what's going to happen. We're working with patients in Istanbul, Turkey, Alexandria, Egypt, Cairo, Egypt. The poor people, the ones who can't afford these nonsense drugs, these immunotherapies, are going to be the ones that are going to be the survivors of cancer.
Very interesting.
It's not the rich. The rich go to the best places.
Yes.
It's just like Semmelweis's experiments with the hand washing. All of the rich people wanted to be seen by the physicians, and they had a very high incidence of childbed fever. The ones that delivered birth by the midwives had very low incidence. Mm-hmm. So the rich people were dying, and the poor people were surviving. Right. The same thing is going to happen in cancer. Poor people can't afford all this stuff, but they want to live. Everybody wants to live, right? So you're going to say, why are all these poor people who don't have any money surviving cancer when all the rich guys go to the hospitals and they suffer and die? So it's going to come around like that.
I think that's very interesting. I came across a bit of a parallel. I was talking to a world-leading expert on photodynamic therapy, which has been largely ignored in this country, even though a lot of it was developed here.
Yeah.
And he's in a situation where he can set up a clinic for £8,000 and treat patients for £200 a go.
Yeah.
Well, the NHS is never going to do anything as cheap as that. So he's now busy setting up third world countries with his equipment.
Oh, absolutely.
They're benefiting from it, and we don't get it.
No, and I think that's going to happen with cancer as well, because the people in Cairo are really anxious about this. Mm. So Alexandria and Istanbul, Turkey. I'm not saying Turkey is a third world country, but it's moving in the metabolic direction.
Yes, yeah.
And I think that once people understand the concepts, and these are not terribly difficult concepts, glucose and glutamine are driving your cancer. Okay, doctor, what are you doing to stop availability of glucose and glutamine to my cancer? Well, if he says, well, it's, gives you some roundabout argument, or, well, that's not true. Well, he obviously doesn't know anything. He doesn't know the biology of the problem. So these are very simple questions that people can ask their oncologists. Doctor, how are you stopping the availability of glucose and glutamine to my tumor? Because they can't live without glucose and glutamine. And if he doesn't know, you better find somebody who does know.
Right. Okay, that's a very good pointer. Yeah. Since your book came out, Cancer as a Metabolic Disease, there has been more interest in the scientific community in metabolic theory. And so with that added interest, the goalposts will have moved, new things will have been discovered. How have your views changed in the last 6 years?
Well, I've become, I think my views have changed in knowing that what I wrote originally is even more solid than what I thought when I wrote it.
Really?
So I've had a lot more evidence from finding older articles that I may have missed in the first go around, really solidifying unquestionably that Otto Warburg was right. Unquestionably showing that glucose and glutamine are the two major drivers of cancer. Many, many, many more papers. Unquestionably that the respiration of cancer is defective. If the respiration is defective, the only way to get ATP energy is to ferment. And the fermentation pathways are ancient, and they have been upregulated in these cancer cells. And all these oncogenes are simply transcription factors that bring in more fermentable fuels, allows the cells to get more glucose and glutamine. So I've become more convinced in understanding the preciseness that cancer is a mitochondrial metabolic disease. This now allows us to have so many new ways to manage the disease. And I think people who are starting to do this are realizing, they've come to me and they ask me, oh, you can't believe I found this particular compound that really, really works well, and we think it's targeting both glucose and glutamine. You might want to look into this. And they're coming with how to improve compliance. And in other words, people are getting very excited, I think, about all of the new options that we have to manage cancer without toxicity. Mm-hmm. And this is where the excitement is.
Definitely.
Yeah. So I think that, not only did I put a lot of things out that were very controversial, but I think now the science behind what I put out is even stronger. Mm-hmm. So, but you still have a huge group of people at the top medical schools who insist that mitochondria are normal in cancer cells. And they say, Siegfried and all these guys there, they don't know what they're talking about. Because you study cancer in a culture dish, as individual cells like they're microorganisms, or you look at the disease in the tissue itself. When you look at the disease in the tissue itself, you see clear abnormalities in mitochondria. When you look at the cells in a culture dish, you don't always see that. So the powers of the scientific community are mostly studying cancer in the dish.
Right.
So they don't see the hard, or they ignore the hard. They see that, I can't believe it, because their culture. So we have now determined that the real understanding of cancer comes entirely from a culture dish, growing cancer cells as microorganisms. Microorganisms ferment. Cancer cells, even the normal cells ferment when you put them in the culture dish.
Right.
So you can't see what Warburg really was showing. But when you see it in the tissue, you say, my God, these tumor cells have very few mitochondria, and the ones they have are very dysmorphic. Structure dictates function. Then how are they living? Why are they growing so fast? They're fermenting. What's the evidence for that? Well, they're taking up a lot of glucose. How do you know? Well, they light up on PET scan.
I know, that's the old...
right?
The old,
and then they say, well, there's some cancer. See, Warburg's wrong because some cancers don't light up on a PET scan. I says, well, look at their glutamine consumption, and you'll find out they're taking in tremendous amounts of glutamine. So if you don't target glucose and glutamine simultaneously, the cancer cell will have the opportunity to survive. So if you target the two fuels together, the probability of long-term survival becomes much less probable. That's the way I can encapsulate this. So target glucose and glutamine. Now, of course, the pharmaceutical companies are not blind to this. They're trying to develop these glutamine inhibitors. The problem is they're trying to do it so they can make a tremendous amount of money by targeting some isozyme of an enzyme. And what we do is we don't do that because there's so many isozymic forms of these different transporters and certain receptors. It's best just to take away the fuel itself Oh, but that's so simple, and that's so cost-effective, and that's so, and therefore we can't make money on it. Therefore, it can't be any good.
And drug companies love blocking, don't they? That's their favorite thing. Blocking.
Yeah, they block, but you know, as I said, people want to live, and if you get people and you tell them to do this, you're going to have a greater probability of living. You know, because the whole thing is we have to continue to treat people with toxic radiation and chemo until we find the magic bullet. Well, we've been hunting for that magic bullet for decades, and it's not going to happen. So you've got to embrace, you have to come to the understanding that this is a metabolic disease, and for the first time, this whole concept can't, we hear it everywhere in the States and England. He's battling his cancer. He's battling. He's not battling anything. He's sitting on his ass, and he's being poisoned and irradiated. Right? What is he doing to battle his cancer, other than getting off his ass and sitting down in the radiation shop and have him nuked, right? He's not battling his cancer. But when you do metabolic therapy, it's up to you to make sure that you remain vigilant in keeping your blood sugars, and you can do that yourself if you want to live. Now, there are people on the planet who simply don't want to take charge of their existence. It's unbelievable. Well, we always have standard of care for those individuals. There'll always be this traditional radiation and chemo for those folks who don't want to take charge. But believe me, there's a lot of people out there that want to participate in their healing process. And these are the people that we think we're going to be the ones that really...
The things we need to tell what's going on.
Yeah, they need to know that.
So you're getting ever more behind Mr. Warburg and his theory in the first place. Do you think it's as bad as that we've taken an 80 or 90 year detour to come back to where he left off? In the 21st century, is there all that time in between of billions of research and effort being all wasted?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, not all wasted. Obviously, the purpose of cancer research is to continue to support people doing research, right?
Yeah, but in a sense,
they're contributing to the economy.
Yeah,
you know, they're buying things, and the economy is going good, and the government gives them money. Therefore, they buy stuff. They buy equipment from these supply houses. They buy very fancy radiation machines. You know, they buy all this stuff, keeps the economy going. But the cancer bodies are piling up. So you have to look at it and say, well, what would happen if we, you know, cut cancer death rates by 50% in 10 years if we didn't irradiate? Well, what are all these poor guys going to do making all these big money, you know, treating cancer patients? I don't know. I mean, maybe they should start looking into metabolic therapies, hyperbaric oxygen and these kinds of things. But, you know, so it's a terrible situation because you say to the cancer patient, you know, you have this disease, it's a tragedy, and we're going to treat you with these toxic chemicals, and with there, by the grace of God, you might survive. But you know, you're serving society a tremendous service by keeping so many people functional. You can't tell people that. This is a disgrace.
That's a very good message.
No, but you know, basically, you know, this is what's happening, and I feel terrible about it, and I think that, you know, once we all want to improve life, and we want to treat people in the right way. And we're not doing that now, and I think it's going to be a very bitter pill to swallow for certain people doing certain things at this time in the cancer field.
So, would you say you are confident that the information you hold has the potential to turn around that terrible upward tide of statistics of cancer incidence?
Yeah, as I said, if we implemented metabolic therapy in light of the press pulse therapeutic strategy that I published with my physician colleagues. This is an outline. It's a blueprint, a pathway to long-term non-toxic management of cancer. We have one of the major things to still work out is dosage, timing, and scheduling. We have a lot of drugs and procedures that are part of the press pulse therapy. We have not yet found the optimal dosages, the correct timing, or the correct scheduling of how to apply the full. We're seeing, it's like an engine that is turning over and kicking a little bit, and it runs for a short period of time and then stops. We're in that rough stage yet, but I think this is a solvable problem. This is not trying to discover a new kind of drug or, you know, we just have to work out the details. And then I think, as I've said, we could drop cancer death rates by 50% in 10 to 15 years. And the reason why it would take 10 to 15 years is because we don't have enough people trained to know how to do this. So there's a training process. Mm-hmm. How many physicians would like to be trained to know metabolic therapy? Are the medical establishments allowing us to treat patients? with metabolic therapy. And we're not allowed to do that. Physicians are fearful of losing their license for treating patients outside the standard of care. And this is a stumbling block. IRB, institutional review boards, refuse to allow people to be treated with metabolic therapy, right? Because it's a terrible threat, and they don't understand it. And yet cancer patients are dying. You know, it's like, you know, give me, what, don't you interested in saving the lives? Well, it hasn't been proven by clinical trials. You look at the data, you look at the evidence, and you can see that what I'm saying is absolutely correct. Why, if you know it works and you've seen enough working on individual patients in preclinical studies, and no one wants to set up a clinical trial, but of course, who does the clinical trial? Who pays for the clinical trial? Pharmaceutical companies. Are they interested in doing metabolic therapy, which would eliminate the use of these toxic drugs? So you have to say, you know, these are stumbles, these are just continual, you know, firewalls that are put in to keep the status quo, right? But as I said over and over again, we have 1,600 people a day dying, and it's getting worse, and people want to live. Something has to crack. Something has to change. Otherwise, the numbers of dead people and cancer is going to increase. It's already in epidemic proportions. And from what we heard today at this meeting of all the toxins in the environment, it's going to continue. It's going to get worse unless you're willing to make a fundamental change in how you view the origin of this disease.
We're going to have to end it there, Professor Seyfried. Your passion for all this stuff absolutely comes through, and you've put so much effort and skill and everything else into bringing this to the attention of the scientific community and to the public. I mean, it's fantastic what you're doing, and
it's
a real honour to have you on the show. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Robin. Pleasure to be here.
Professor Seyfried is a man on a mission, if ever there was one. It's incredible what he's achieved already, and I sincerely hope he manages to achieve his aims of making successful metabolic treatments widely available to all. Look out for links to material mentioned in the interview on the Yes to Life website, that's yestolife.org.uk. Click the radio show logo that's on the homepage. And a last call for participants in the Yes to Life 10K run in Victoria Park, London on the 6th of October. To find out about the run and to register, go to yestolife10k.org, that's yestolife10k.org, where you'll find full details. Thanks for listening today. I look forward to introducing another guest from the world of integrative medicine to you next week. Goodbye.